Conspiracy theories have been part of our politics for a long time, but these days, belief in those theories are part of why our country is so divided. We'll learn how that happened. Plus, are you a parent traveling with kids over the summer? It can be hard to find good things to listen to that everyone can enjoy, but we're going to hear about two podcasts that are fun for both kids and adults. And for the month of June, the Chicago Tribune is putting the spotlight on Black food on the city's south side.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, why the Chicago Tribune is spending the entire month highlighting Black food on the city's south side. Plus, we'll share two podcasts we think are great to listen to with kids. But first, American politics has had no shortage of its conspiracy theories. Think about questions about who shot JFK or Area 51. But in the past few years, it's easy to name so many more, whether we're talking about Pizzagate, birthers, the death of Vince Foster. At the same time, our politics have become so much more polarized. So University of Chicago political scientist Eric Oliver has asked, could the force driving conspiracy theories also be the same one that's dividing our country? He's on the line with us now to talk about his research. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
So when we think about conspiracies in this world of political fake news, our own President Trump fueled fire that former President Obama wasn't a citizen, that's a conspiracy that lingers today. How much lingering are we talking about? Do we know how many people still believe that, even though that is not true?
Sure. So I've been asking in public opinion surveys over the past 10 years a variety of questions about conspiracy theories. So I've been trying to take six or seven common conspiracy theories, things like the truther conspiracy theory that 9/11 was an inside job, for example, or the birther conspiracy that you just mentioned about Barack Obama. And we typically find when we do surveys that about half of Americans will agree with at least one conspiracy theory. And so when we first started doing this, we were pretty surprised about this. The fact that, you know, at least one in two of us will agree with one conspiracy theory that's generally kind of out there. So this
wow, that's a lot, kind of Eric.
It is. And it really surprised us. And if you look at some of the specific numbers, you know, even today, while, you know, at its peak, I should say, for example, the birther conspiracy theory, about 25% of the people, the American public, was agreeing with the birther conspiracy theory. That number's gone down somewhat since Barack Obama has left office. We still get around anywhere from like 15 to 18% of people believing that 9/11 was an inside job.
Inside job meaning the American government did it?
That the American government secretly planned the attacks of 9/11 in order to facilitate going to war in the Middle East. That's the conspiracy theory.
Oh, okay. And then what are the other big conspiracy theories that are out there?
Well, probably the most popular one is as a kind of a less partisan conspiracy theory. And this is the idea that the Food and Drug Administration is deliberately withholding natural cures from cancer from making it onto the market because of secret pressure from the pharmaceutical industry.
Hmm.
And we usually get about 40% of Americans agreeing with that.
Wow. Okay. So you've been studying why so many people believe conspiracy theories and what that says about how we understand the world. What have you learned? Are there sort of basic personality traits or beliefs that correlate with belief in conspiracies?
Sure. So when we started doing this research, then once we were struck by, wow, the large numbers of people believing in this, we were trying to figure out, well, who exactly was doing this and why? And some of the things that we might expect, like, for example, people who are less trusting of others tend to, you know, we ask people, do you think people can generally be trusted in these types of questions? Those types of people are more likely to believe in conspiracy theories, not surprising there. Some of the more surprising things, though, came from people who have a lot of supernatural or paranormal beliefs. tend to be very much more likely to believe in conspiracy theories. So, for example, you know, if you believe in ESP or ghosts, or you believe that, you know, God has a plan for everyone, those people who embrace those types of beliefs tend to also are more tend to be more much more likely to believe in conspiracy theories.
And then you actually break this down, like, into whether people are intuitionists or rationalists. That's kind of how you understand it.
Well, this is what then prompted so we just finished a book about this called Enchanted America. And the idea of the book is that American politics are not simply organized by things like partisanship or ideology or even race, but by what we might call worldview. And at one end of this worldview are people we call rationalists. And these are people who rely on deduction and facts and logic and reason to understand what's going on in the world. And on the other end of the spectrum are people we call intuitionists. And intuitionists tend to go with their gut feelings. They're heavily swayed by symbols and metaphors. And they really go much more with their heart than their head when they're trying to understand the world. And what we basically find is that people who believe in conspiracy theories, just like people who have a lot of supernatural beliefs or paranormal beliefs, tend to be much more stronger on the intuitionist side of the spectrum. They tend to really be people who go more with their guts, and they listen to what their gut is telling them. And, you know, if they're feeling apprehensive, their gut is telling them that the world's a scary place and that there's probably something going on that they need to be worried about.
And does that correlate with political or ideological belief, whether you are in either of these, whether you're an intuitionist or a rationalist?
Yes. So our theory was that we've only been collecting data on this for the past few years. But we think that historically, these two things have not been necessarily aligned with politics. And, you know, you would find intuitionists on the political left just as you would find them on the political right. But what we found when we were doing our surveys and when we were measuring sort of this intuitionist proclivity, that we were beginning to see a much stronger political alignment. We see far more intuitionists now on the right who identify themselves as conservative, and liberals are much more likely to be, people identify as liberals are much more likely to score high as rationalists. And if you look at a lot of political discourse right now, it's not that surprising. So, you know, you have liberals who go up and they have yard signs that say, "We believe in science." Meanwhile, you have a lot of conservatives who are denying things like climate change. A very large percentage of them are fundamentalist Christians who believe that we're living in end times as foretold by biblical prophecy. What we're beginning to see is something that's changing in American politics. And I think the biggest example of this, if you look at a lot of rationalist conservatives that are out there, so like someone like a Bret Stephens, who's a columnist for the New York Times, you know, he is somebody who feels very right now on the margins of conservatism because his type of perspective is really being supplanted by this much more intuitionist worldview, which is, you know, based on conspiracy theories and kind of gut feelings and, you know, this kind of more visceral reaction to politics.
So I wonder, Eric, how your research gives you insight into how conservatives and liberals prefer to communicate or be communicated to.
Well, this is one of the things that I think explains why we have such a strong political divide in this country. If liberals and conservatives, say, for example, were reasonable and rationalistic, they might, you know, disagree about outcomes, but at least the terms of the debate by which they can, you know, discuss politics would be recognizable. But when you have some group that is strongly intuitionist and another group that's strongly rationalist, it's very, very difficult to communicate. I think a lot of people have had the experience, for example, of, you know, being in a family gathering where you have a family member who is a strong conspiracy theorist or has some sort of strong magical belief, and you're trying to dissuade this person. You can see how difficult it is to talk them out of it, that these beliefs that they hold are very strongly rooted in their own emotional processes. And so one of the things that we suggest in our research is that this is why America seems so divided. And we had, you know, we were interviewing people for the book, and we had one person who we were interviewing, and we were going back and forth and trying to understand the logic behind a lot of her inconsistent kind of political ideas. And she turned to us and she said, "Well, you know, the difference between you and me is that you believe in reason and I believe in the Bible." And that was a very prescient statement on her part. Like the kinds of criteria that we, for example, as academics employ in thinking about politics, were just not that relevant for her. And she had a different guidepost for how she kind of understood what was happening in the world.
I'm speaking with Eric Oliver. His book that he's talking about is called Enchanted America, How Intuition and Reason Divide Our Politics. He teaches political science at the University of Chicago. Eric, and so when we think about that, you said that historically these things haven't been aligned with politics. What do you think has changed? Because I imagine you would think this changed before President Trump took office.
Yes, this has been going on for a while. And if you go back and say, look in at the late 1950s, and you would poll most Americans, almost everyone in the United States believed in God. And there was really, really broad enthusiasm for science and the progress of science. And there was this kind of consensus around those types of issues. And as a country, we've really begun to polarize on this dimension. We probably have around 20 to 25% of Americans who no longer believe in God. And you have a significant chunk of Americans who believe in sort of very strong fundamentalist ideas about God. And conversely, we're also seeing this big division on science now, where some people are very trusting of science and some people mistrusting of science. And I think one of the reasons why this aligned was the mobilization of conservative Christians into politics. And this started happening in the 1970s, partly in response to things like the Supreme Court getting rid of prayer in public school, affirming abortion rights in Roe v. Wade. I think there was also a great apprehension among Southern conservatives with the civil rights movement that parochial schools in the South would become integrated. And there was a great sort of racial apprehension about this. And so this served to really kind of politicize Southern conservatives. And they moved into the Republican Party. And this really started happening in the 1980s. And this fusion of Southern conservatives with a lot of moral traditionalism into kind of the traditional economic liberalism of conservatism in the United States really kind of was what the Reagan coalition was built around. And you could see signs of this. So, you know, Pat Buchanan, for example, running in the 1990s, he was somebody who was really appealing to kind of an intuitionist framework. Sarah Palin was another figure who really sort of animated this aspect of the party. And I think when you see with Donald Trump is kind of he now has empowered this element of the conservative movement. That's a very strongly intuitionist movement. I mean, if you look at Donald Trump's rhetoric, it's an intuitionist rhetoric. He himself says, you know, I don't really think about problems. I just go with my gut, you know, and it's not, you know, coincidental that he then also believes in traffics and conspiracy theories. And there's a whole constellation of other kinds of attitudes that kind of go with this sort of intuitionist perspective.
But where do most people lay on the spectrum? Are they, it's because I feel like what you've described are maybe people who have pretty strong beliefs who tend to maybe be on the edges. Are most people like that?
Well, another way of thinking about this is like ideology. You know, we often talk in terms of politics of liberals and conservatives, but most Americans are actually pretty moderate in their political views. And the same thing we could say with intuitionism and rationalism. And according to our measures, most people are somewhere in between. And if you think about it, you know, we all tend to rely on both our intuitions at times and our reason at times. But where people are in terms of how much they rely on one another can actually say a lot about their politics. Some of the factors that determine where people are on this scale are, were they raised, for example, in a religiously conservative household, the amount of education that they have, the amount of stress that they feel. People who tend to be stressed more tend to be a lot more intuitionist in their orientation. There's some personality differences, like some people like to think about problems and solve problems and really like puzzles, and those people tend to be a lot more rationalistic. Some people just don't like to think very hard about issues, and they tend to be more intuitionist.
Eric, when we think about this, I wondered if I could just end by asking you about if the goal is to reduce some of these divisions, as we talked about polarization and how far apart people are, but we've also, through your research, learned a little bit about communication. Do you feel like, what have you learned anything helpful about how we can maybe reduce some of the divisions that we have?
So I've been trying to think a lot about this. And the story that keeps coming to mind is when my son was 5 years old and he was really scared about a monster in the closet. And, you know, he was screaming one night, and I came in and I, you know, turned on the lights in this room and I opened up the closet and I was trying to reason with him and telling him there's no monster in the closet. And finally he turned and looked at me and he said, well, you know, if there's no monster in the closet, then why am I afraid? And I think this actually speaks to this intuitionist reason debate. When someone who's taking a reasoned position is trying to speak to someone who has an intuitionist perspective, reasoning with them is not going to work very well. But listening to them and acknowledging the source of their emotions and their apprehensions and their anxieties can be a way, I think, of fostering better dialogue and better understanding. And I think it's oftentimes difficult for people who have a rationalist perspective to find out a way to communicate somebody who's an intuitionist because, you know, intuitions aren't necessarily clear to us. They seem to come from, like, the murky depths of our gut. And I think the first step is by acknowledging that, you know, people who typically are relying on their intuitions are probably doing so because they're feeling pretty apprehensive and they're feeling pretty anxious about something. And I think acknowledging the sources of that apprehension or anxiety is probably the first step to then kind of facilitating kind of a greater communication and trying to talk across this gulf.
And are we assuming that the rationalists are the only ones trying to communicate? I wonder how we can think about how intuitionists can better listen to rationalists.
Yes, true. And I think that's, you know, it's not just sort of on one side. And I think the other part of this is to say, you know, we live in a liberal democracy, and a liberal democracy is a product of the Enlightenment. It's a reason-based system. And, you know, reason has created, you know, our science has created incredible benefits for our society in terms of health, our economy, our well-being. And, you know, continuing to remind people that, you know, science and reason are serving us very, very well. And when we deviate from that is typically when we see disasters. So I think some sort of reminding of that is also important as well.
That's Eric Oliver. He's the co-author of Enchanted America, How Intuition and Reason Divide Our Politics. He's a professor of political science at the University of Chicago. We've been talking about some of his research. We will tweet it out and have some links at our website, too, if you want to read more about this. Eric, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you so much for having me on.
Coming up after the break, we're wrapping up our series this week on podcasts we're listening to this summer. We're going to bring you two shows that are great for both kids and parents. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. All this week, we've been offering some summer podcast recommendations, and we've compiled all of them at 21stshow.org in case you've missed the other ones. But we didn't want to forget all the parents and the kids who were out there traveling this summer. The podcast, The Unexplainable Disappearance of Mars Patel, is a Peabody Award-winning show from a company called Gen Z Media. It's a scripted mystery series read by kids for kids, but it's also meant to keep parents equally entertained as families listen together. David Kreisman is the head writer for The Unexplainable Disappearance of Mars Patel and is joining us now from New Jersey to tell us more about this mystery series. Hi, David. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Glad to be here.
So this podcast has been described as a combination of, for people who are familiar with the Netflix show Stranger Things and the classic 80s movie Goonies. I wonder, do you like that description? How would you describe it?
Yeah, I think that's pretty good. Although we started writing this before Stranger Things ever came out, and then Stranger Things came out and we sort of saw the similarities and then we were worried about it. But I think that's right. Stranger Things is about kids, but it's for adults, and Mars Patel is really for kids, for middle grade kids. Kind of the Harry Potter audience is who we look for. So 8 to 12 is the sweet spot, although there are kids who are younger that listen, kids who are older that listen, and a lot of parents who like to sneak and listen even when their kids aren't in the car.
And Stranger Things is pretty scary, not necessarily appropriate for the age range. That's not the case with Mars Patel.
No, that's right. There's certainly a mystery involved, and there's some tension, and there's some moments where, you know, maybe a kid is going to move a little closer to their parents while they're listening, but certainly not scary.
And so we wanted to set up the story a little bit for people who haven't heard this podcast, and we've got a little bit of audio from the very first episode that can help us set the scene here.
Take a listen as I drop you into the hallway of H.G. Wells Middle School and into the middle of a mystery. Mars and his pals Jonas and Caddy haven't heard from their friend Aurora in... How long has it been, Mars?
5 days. 5 days what?
You know what he's talking about, Jonas.
Oh, great. He's on the Aurora thing again.
It's not the Aurora thing. She's gone.
A person is made of matter. A person has mass. She's not gone.
She's not gone. 5 days since Aurora disappeared. She isn't responding to text or calls.
And that's some audio from the podcast, The Unexplainable Disappearance of Mars Patel. David Kreisman is with us. He's the head writer of this. So, okay, so that sets up a little bit of it there. So in the first season, actually in the first episode, we learned that Aurora, and I'm not going to give any spoilers away, but there are other students that go missing. But it's up to the kids, right, to try to solve
That's right. It's this feeling where these kids' friends are disappearing. And the adults don't seem to be alarmed by it. They have excuses for why suddenly someone would stop coming to school and stop answering their text messages. And so the kids start to wonder, you know, what's going on here? Where are my friends? But also, who's in on it? Who can I trust? Can I trust people at the school? Can I trust my own parents? And it's this mystery that really takes them on an epic journey.
And I wonder, can you tell us about Mars Patel? I love the character. Mars is his nickname, obviously, because I imagine, as I heard, his mom calls him, his real name is Manu.
Yes, that's right. And Mars is someone who is very curious, tends to get himself in trouble a lot. He's a good kid, but has a little trouble with authority sometimes, has trouble following the rules, and has always felt like there's something else out there. That there's something special about him that he hasn't been able to put his finger on. And when this mystery happens, there's something in him that tells him he's got to pursue this to the end. And he has this group of friends, Toothpick and Caddy and JP. Each of them is a bit of a misfit. They don't necessarily fit in with everybody else at school, but they've kind of found each other and formed this group. And it's this group that has to work together to solve the mystery.
David, I wonder what you think kids get from listening to this podcast that they maybe wouldn't get. I think kids these days are really into watching YouTube, so videos, or playing video games. What is it like when you're thinking about creating an audio, just an audio experience for kids?
Well, what we love about it is that it really allows them to use their imagination. A lot of times, kids who are listening to this show, and we, our company, Gen Z Media, has a lot of audio dramas. We have about 7 shows out, another 10 in development, all for this audience. And most of the time when a kid listens to these shows, it's their first experience with listening to a podcast or an audio drama. So they're reluctant at first. They don't really know what to do with it at first.
They probably don't really get it, right?
Exactly. But it doesn't take long for them to get sucked in. And they really are very passionate about it. Our audience is very passionate about it. And we hear from parents all the time about how their kids just, they beg to listen to it. They can't wait to go on car trips to listen to the next episode or another one of our series. And same things we've heard from teachers in classrooms where it's the thing that calms their class down more than anything else. You know, they turn it on and suddenly everybody's just, you know, in rapt attention. I think one of the things that makes audio drama special is how immersive it is. You know, it goes right in your ears, into your brain, and then your brain is making the pictures. And so I think kids really feel like they're right in the middle of the action. You can see when they're watching how into it they are. Another thing that we think is great about it is how much co-listening is done. Our studies have shown that 90% of the listening to our shows is kids and parents listening together, which is pretty rare for all forms of media. And then they talk about it afterwards. So it really is kind of a communal family experience.
And you've written for TV, right, David? I wonder how writing for a podcast, and especially a podcast, a scripted series for children, is different. Because this is such a different medium. It's not about the visuals. It's really about what the words are and how much imagination you're sparking there.
That's right. And it was a bit of a learning curve in the very beginning for me of figuring out how to tell the story without always having to explain. You know, the things you take for granted when you're writing TV, when someone walks into a room, you can see what the room is, you can see what they're wearing, you see what they're holding in your hand. How do you explain those things without saying, oh, here I am in my bedroom and I'm holding a glass in my hand? How to do it with sound design, subtly through the dialogue, with sound effects, all of those things that you don't want to over-explain.
So you mentioned Gen Z Media. That's the company that you write for. They actually have other kids' podcasts. And you were also a parent. I wonder, do you write these with your kids in mind?
I do. My daughter actually was a character on Mars Patel. She plays Epica.
Oh.
Mean girl.
Okay.
Mars Patel. Yes. And yeah, I talk to my kids about it a lot. We bounce ideas back and forth. I play them rough recordings and get their thoughts on it. So they're definitely in my mind a lot when we're coming up with these shows.
And if people want to listen to The Unexplainable Disappearance of Mars Patel, there's also another one we haven't talked about, 6 Minutes, I know is pretty popular. How can they do that?
You can listen to season one of Mars Patel on iTunes or Stitcher, wherever you get podcasts. It's also available on a service called Pinna, which is a subscription service that has a lot of great kids' podcasts.
For seasons 2 and 3.
Correct. And 6 Minutes is available also anywhere you get podcasts.
Great. That's David Kreisman, the head writer of the Peabody Award-winning podcast for kids, The Unexplainable Disappearance of Mars Patel. The third and final season of that podcast was just released earlier this year. David, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you're looking for a nonfiction podcast for kids, one that delves into some big questions, we have another recommendation for you. It's called Brains On, a science podcast from American Public Media that even curious adults will find interesting. Molly Bloom co-hosts the show with a young guest host each week, and she's with us now. Hi, Molly. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us about the premise of Brains On?
Brains On is a show that answers questions from our listeners from around the world. They send us tons of questions every day. We look through these, we pick some to answer, and we answer them in fun and creative ways. Every episode is hosted by me along with a kid co-host. And, you know, we tackle everything from, you know, why is the ocean salty, to do dogs know their dogs? And we sort of follow that question wherever it leads us. Often my kid co-host will interview scientists as part of the show, and then we'll do what we call skitsplanations, where we'll break down something complicated, you know, by talking to a scientist and including sort of, I guess, sort of like anthropomorphized either molecules or animals to sort of explain the point that's being made. And sometimes we even have songs. We just try to have it be really fun and make it feel like science is a party that everyone's invited to.
And so the kids submit the questions. How many questions have you guys received?
Oh, my goodness. A lot. We've lost track. We have a big, you know, database. People send us, people can fill out forms on our website to submit questions. And we've gotten probably 20,000 questions at this point, maybe more.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot. We'll be busy for a while.
Okay. I want to get to the guest hosts and ask you about that. But first, I just want to ask you about these questions again, because sometimes they're really big questions. They're questions that not just children or kids, but adults have. You actually just did a whole series on emotions, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so that, you know, we've gotten over time, you know, when we pick the episodes we're going to do, there are themes that clearly emerge. And over time, we've gotten a ton of questions about all sorts of different emotions, you know, broad questions like, where do emotions come from? How do I control my emotions? To very specific ones of like, what evolutionary purpose does anger serve? And so we wanted to answer all of these questions about emotions in this 4-part series. And we have grouped them by happy, sad, angry, and nervous. And it's been really interesting for us to explore those questions, because every episode we make, we learn just as much as the kids who are listening, I think. And we've done a lot in these episodes about, you know, sort of how being mindful, you know, noticing your emotions can help you sort of wrap your arms around them a little bit better.
We've actually got a little clip of this.
All that really means is, if you're a young penguin, spending time with other young penguins, actually penguins your age or even penguins who are a tiny bit older, tiny bit more experienced, can help you be safer, which can make you feel less nervous.
Hey, Peg Whitney, can I hang out with you and learn from your older, wiser, penguin-y ways?
So that's a clip from Brains On. It's a science podcast for kids, for curious adults, for anyone really who has questions about them. Molly Bloom is the host of it. This is produced by American Public Media, and she's talking to me now. So Molly, I wanted to ask you about your co-hosts. How do those get chosen?
So a lot of our co-hosts are just listeners of our show. So recently we did an episode about, is it possible for an echo to go on forever? And we reached out to the girl who had written to us with that question actually a few years ago now. It's been on our list for a long time, and she still listens to our show, and we asked her if she wanted to be the co-host for that episode, so she came on. And then, Dekari, who is the co-host of our Feeling series, he came to us through the Holistic Life Foundation. We reached out to them because they do some really amazing work in Baltimore in schools, helping teach yoga and meditation to kids as a way to help them deal with their feelings. And so Dekari is a mentor through that program. He actually teaches like little preschool age kids how to meditate. So sometimes we'll have sort of experts like Dekari, kid experts on as co-hosts, but a lot of times they're just listeners to our show.
Right. And in those episodes, the ones about feelings, it really sounds like, and we heard that in that clip, that you're giving kids not just scientific information, but also strategies for things that can help make them feel better if they are feeling sad, not just recognizing it, but then as well as dealing with it.
Definitely. Yeah. The Feeling series is one where we felt like it would be really appropriate to answer some of those questions that kids had sent us about how do I control my feelings, or what do I do when I'm feeling sad? Some of the other topics we do, there aren't sort of like direct things that really affect kids' lives, but we've seen that after they listen, they want to go out and find more information or do experiments or check out books in the library. So this is another way that kids, can sort of get involved after listening, is sort of trying some of these techniques that we're sharing in the show.
We were just talking to another podcast that is about kids for children or for older kids. It's called The Unexplainable Disappearance of Mars mm-hmm. Patel. And one of the writers was telling us about how what they really like about it is that kids listen with adults. And I wonder if that's something that's important for you, that you're hoping that parents are listening with their children.
Yeah, when we designed the show, we wanted it to be one that was not annoying for adults to listen to, too, because we knew that there would probably be a lot of family listening that happens. And we actually got a grant from the National Science Foundation a couple years ago to study, sort of the impact of listening to Brains On. And through that study, we found that there is a ton of what is called joint media engagement, which is that families listening together. And, and a lot of it is happening in cars, which makes sense. So, we heard that of our listeners, 95% of them have listened in the car together as a family, and that it has sparked conversation. And we build those sort of opportunities for conversation and interactivity into the show. So we have a mystery sound segment where we play a sound for kids to guess what it is. And we've heard that's really popular for, people will pause the show and talk about what they think it is and then listen to the answer later. So we know that that's happening, and that is important to us to make those opportunities for families to talk about it.
And Molly, I wonder from the research what you found, why it was important to have that joint media consumption between parents and kids.
Well, I think for parents, it's, a lot of times when kids are looking at screens, it's a little, I guess isolating in a way where they're sort of just looking at their screen in the back seat of the car. But when you're playing something through the speakers in the car, everyone's hearing it. And it's a really good opportunity for parents to talk to their kids about something they're all experiencing together. But we've heard from parents that it also is a jumping off point to hear about what the kid did at school that day. So we've heard from our listeners that it's sparking general conversation beyond just what we're talking about in the show, which is really cool.
Yeah, more than just a science podcast. Mm-hmm. So that's Molly Bloom. You can get Brains On. You can listen to it wherever you get your podcasts. It's produced by American Public Media for not just kids, but curious adults. Molly, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Chicago is one of the top dining destinations in the entire country, but when it comes to how we write about and talk about the food in Chicago, which restaurants get the most recognition? All this month, the Chicago Tribune is putting the spotlight on Black food and culture, specifically on Chicago's South Side. The newspaper is featuring more than a dozen South Side establishments, new and old, and sharing favorites, but it's tackling more than just food. It's also taking a look at the history, traditions, and culture that have shaped the people in places that are part of this food. Sade Carpenter is on the line with us now from Chicago, where she's the deputy food and dining editor for the Tribune. Sade, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me, Nyla.
So you started the piece you wrote for the Tribune introducing this month-long series talking about your own family's roots in Chicago. I wonder if you can first tell us about your mother and father and their connection to Chicago's South Side.
Absolutely. You know, both of my parents have Southside roots, although my mother was born in Mississippi, but she and her family traveled north to Chicago when she was seven. So during the Great Migration, just like millions of other Black people did, moving from the South to the North to find better opportunity. And my father, he was born in the Southside neighborhood of Chicago in Inglewood. I don't honestly know why they remember the intersections and things like that, because I can't even remember where I lived like 3 years ago. But he remembers that he was born at 63rd and State Street and, you know, grew up from that point in several different houses on the South Side before moving on to the South Suburbs. And of course, my parents didn't know each other at the time. They were about three or four, but they only lived about a couple of miles from each other. She lived a little bit north of where he was, also in Inglewood. So that's their kind of root story. And then I, too, was born on the South Side in Bronzeville at the now-closed Michael Reese Hospital, but I grew up mostly in the South and Southwest suburbs.
And so you say you're a Pride, you wrote this, that you were a Pride Hyde Park resident now, but I don't know if I've, right, quote, ever feel like I've earned the right to call myself a Southsider. So yeah. What were you thinking when you wrote earning the right?
Well, you know, as people from Chicago are very particular about basically
who gets to have the title of Chicagoan, right?
Truly. And I went to college in Iowa, and a lot of people would just be like, oh, you're from Chicago. It's like, no, I'm from the suburbs of Chicago. I have to be particular about it because I don't want to be called out, honestly. And it's not the same thing. I had a completely different upbringing, you know, not belonging to Chicago public schools and not having to deal with some of the challenges that many of our Chicago students do. So it's an important distinction, I think, to make.
When you were growing up, I wonder where were your favorite places that you guys ate with your family on the South Side?
Yeah, one of my biggest memories and one of the things that stands out most from childhood is just all the drives we would take from the suburbs to the city, whether we were visiting my grandmother or, you know, an auntie. I always looked forward to that chance to get out of the burbs and get in the city and try some new food. One thing we used to do was go to Lim's Barbecue for a rib tip specifically. And honestly, at the time, I wasn't so much of a rib eater. I just loved the fries.
Can we stop for a second, though, and talk about how famous,
sure,
Lim's rib tips are in the barbecue world?
Yes, super famous. One of our reporters, Nick Kindlesberger, is working on a barbecue story now as part of the Southside Month Focus, and he brought Lim's back yesterday to the newsroom, and, you know, everyone was just crowded around eating the rib tips because they're an institution, truly. It's delicious, and, you know, it's a long-standing barbecue spot on the South Side of Chicago.
Mm-hmm. And so I wonder what the conversations were like in the newsroom when you decided to do this for the Tribune, to spend a month spotlighting, mm-hmm, specifically Black food and culture on Chicago's South Side?
Yes. We always have a focus each month, like the month before June and May, we focused on starters, small plates, and appetizers. And so we always have conversations before the month comes in order to plan our coverage, to think about our approach, to think about, you know, what we will include and what we won't include. And the conversations began a little bit earlier for June, and we decided that we want to do Chicago's South Side, but are we focused on the entire South Side? Are we going to look at Chinatown? Are we looking at Pilsen? Are we talking about Bridgeport? But as we know, there is kind of an inherent coding to the language when you think about the North Side of Chicago and when you think about the South Side of Chicago. And it's that implicit understanding that North Side means white and Black, South Side means Black. So we decided we're going to focus on Black South Side, and we're going to amplify the coverage in a way that we probably have not done in years past, even though our food and dining team has been covering the South Side for years and has been eating on the South Side and will continue to do so. We wanted to basically just highlight it and spotlight it in a way that was very explicit so that the community knew, hey, we're doing this and we're showcasing you and we want you to know why.
And I think part of that conversation is an acknowledgement that this isn't just a story about food, right? And as often is with food reporting, it's not just about the food. It's so much about the stories of why that food is created or how this restaurant is run. In the case of what you guys have talked about in this month, segregation is a big part of the story. And I wonder how important it was for you all to even acknowledge that and talk about racism and segregation and how that relates to media coverage as well of the South Side.
Right, absolutely. For me, it was one of the most important things we could do. I really care about building trust with our readers, with our audience, and especially when you have an audience like the Black community of Chicago who has been missed or underrepresented in our coverage in the past. I think we have to own up to that. I think you have to be explicit and bold in saying, look, we know we haven't always done right by these communities, but here's what we're trying to do better. And we can't do better without acknowledging the segregation, without acknowledging the racism, without acknowledging the hardships that these communities face. I feel like it would seem disingenuous if we just approached the month without bringing that up, because it's part of the story.
Mm-hmm. And also, do you feel like how much of the part of the story is about housing and the history of the South Side in here?
So much of the reason why Black people live on the South Side specifically is because of the public housing projects that were erected at the time. And because of the Dan Ryan Expressway route, which basically creates a literal barrier between Bridgeport and more southern communities of the city. So there's also, this week we published a story about Spaghetto, and it's a spaghetti, but it's branded that way because it comes from this restaurant, Doughboys. And the chef and owner talks about how spaghetti is a popular dish among Black communities because it's something that you can make a lot of and serve to a lot of people. So it's not just about thinking about what food is going to taste good tonight. It's also looking at how can I feed my family? How can I do that in an economical way when I have very real financial and economical barriers?
So that's Spaghetto, if we can talk about it for a minute. So that's served with fried chicken. It looks so good. So tell us about the spaghetti.
Yeah, it looks delicious. So one of the things I didn't even know until I want to say a few years ago was that I grew up eating spaghetti as like a side dish. We also have it as the main meal where you cook spaghetti with, you know, Italian sausage or ground beef or both, and you can just eat that. But we've also always had it as a side to chicken or to fried fish. And I didn't realize that wasn't a thing that everyone did until one of my friends from South Carolina asked me about, like, why do you guys have fried fish and spaghetti? Like, what's up with that? I'm like, I don't know.
You're like, that's just what we eat.
It's just what we've always eaten. And so Chris Friesen goes on to explain that spaghetti has always been a traditional dish that you eat with chicken or fish. It's always been a staple side in the Black communities. And so his dish is like a take on that. He uses ground turkey instead of the beef or pork. And then he has a vegetarian option as well. But it's basically embracing that Chicago history of this classic Black dish and putting his own spin on it.
And so when we're talking about that classic part of Chicago history and Black food, Nick Kindlesberger wrote about soul food. And one thing that I learned was how many soul food restaurants, I love Pearls, it's such a wonderful place to eat, but how many soul food restaurants have been lost in Chicago over the years? And I wonder, you know, going back to our earlier conversation, how much of that was even chronicled in media coverage for organizations like the Tribune? Probably not very much, right?
Right. It's a good question. I think when I was doing my research, you know, there were some old stories that I was able to find for certain restaurants, but some of them went back, you know, to the 80s or to the 90s. It wasn't in the 2000s even. So, yeah, it just depends a lot on the profile that people are able to achieve. If you're in Hyde Park, it's a lot easier to get media coverage. Hyde Park has a lot of resources and a lot of investment into that neighborhood from the city and from the University of Chicago. But go further south, it's not always the case. And these restaurants, these business owners don't necessarily have the money to afford a public relations team or to even know how to go about making their website and doing all of these things. So we have to get out there. We have to do the reporting. We have to meet them where they are.
And what reception have you gotten from not just the restaurateurs, but patrons about this coverage so far?
The response has been really overwhelming in a great way. I'm nervous about any time like I write something and then publish it, but especially with something of this gravity, especially when we're talking about a community that we've wronged in the past through our coverage or through our lack of coverage, I was really hopeful that the community would take this as a good faith effort. And I've gotten tons of positive emails from readers or my colleagues in the newsroom and in other newsrooms. And it's not just Black people. It's a lot of Black people, and they're all writing in, and that's wonderful. And it's also people on the North Side. There's a reader who wrote in and said he was a 57-year-old white guy from Skokie who normally doesn't go past the South Loop, but now wants to venture down and try out different restaurants. So it's been a really positive reception that I'm so grateful for.
And I wonder, when we think about that, why you think it's important to, I mean, for the people who are listening, you know, our listeners are all outside of the Chicago area. So when they hear Southside, I'm not sure that food is the association when you say Southside of Chicago. And I wonder why you think it's important to have this coverage.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people think Southside and they may think guns. They might think violence. They might think gang crime. And it's not that these issues don't exist. These issues exist in all areas of the city, including the North Side, including, you know, the West Side, including everywhere. But it's important to tell stories about the Black community that are just about everyday life and about the positivity and celebration of everyday life. Everything doesn't have to be a crime story. Everything doesn't have to be about our pain or about our trauma. We can celebrate the Black community too.
And what else can we look forward to reading about this month? I know Louisa Chu wrote about 111 Food Hall. I mentioned Nick's A Soul Food. We just talked about Spaghetto.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we just had the Spaghetto that came out, and we are also looking at either this week or next week. Yeah, June's almost over already, but we have a story about a brewery in Englewood and what strides they're making to, one, have Black people in craft beer, because craft beer is seen as like a very white, you know, industry, and two, just what that's going to mean for the community overall. We also are looking at a story about coffee shops as safe spaces, and as an example of safe spaces, you might have your typical Starbucks, you know, in River North, the Loop area of Chicago, where you don't really think about what kind of resources do we need to provide to this community that they might not have elsewhere. So we have that story coming up that I'm really excited about. We also have a story that looks at felony hiring practices at a group of restaurants on the South Side where they don't care about any records, and, you know, they will be hired without that being an issue. So we're looking at that and why that's important. We also have a feature that's going to talk to people who live on the South Side, and they may not be chefs or restaurateurs, but where are their favorite places to eat? Like, what are their recommendations?
Are you doing anything on bakeries, sweet things on the South Side?
We've had some sweet treats in our cravings gallery. That's consistently being updated every day. We have a new dish, so definitely keep checking that out. The other thing that I was thinking about but didn't say was that we're looking at some mini interviews with entrepreneurs or food activists in the city, people who are working with farming, urban farming, or just different methods of educating the community and empowering the community for food. And so that's before you get to the restaurant part of it, but it's all part of that hospitality. So we still have a lot of stories coming out. I hope people are as excited as we are to tell them. And yeah, Craving Gallery is going to be updated every morning, so you can always check out some tips there.
Right, and the Cravings Gallery is a photo archives. So those are great, especially if you're, I would not recommend looking at those if you're hungry, because they are delicious food pictures with really interesting information and tidbits about the places. We will tweet all of that out. So if you follow us on Twitter, we'll embed it as well at 21stshow.org. All of the work that's being done by the Chicago Tribune this month. Sade Carpenter is its deputy food and dining editor. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
That's all the time we have for today and for this week. On Monday, we'll learn about a new acquisition just announced actually this hour at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. It's a Bible that was given to President Lincoln in 1864. It was a thank you gift for raising money to help wounded Civil War soldiers at a hospital in Philadelphia. It's just one of five or six Bibles that President Lincoln owned, and now one of them is here in Illinois. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.